Hi, how are you? This is Brett. Today is March 19th, and in just a moment, I'm going to be bringing on my friend and school sucks favorite, Nick Hazelton, and we are actually going to be talking about foraging. And this is not to alarm anyone that, like, hey, look, you have to go find food in the woods now. But there are a lot of benefits to this, and I was really excited about it when I first heard about the practice, and I wanted to do a longer form conversation about it. Hey, maybe you're looking for a new outside of the house activity, and I wanted to check in with Nick and go over the basics of foraging. And I would appreciate it if you stayed tuned till the end, because that's where the safety tips are. So I feel like I'm being responsible just by telling you there are safety tips in this, and you're going to want the safety tips. I know, you know, not every, it's an hour, so not everybody listens to the end of every show, but thank you to those of you who do. And I will talk to you and somebody else from my world again soon, hopefully early next week. All right, everybody, take care. You want to just start right now? We're plenty comfortable with each other, right?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm ready.
Oh, man. Nick, first time I talked to you was like 6 years ago.
I know. I've been thinking about this recently. A lot of I'm finally like at the point where I know enough people that out of my history around here, you know, like all the people I grew up with are like, oh, stupid Nick, you dropped out of high school.
Yeah.
Now I'm meeting all these other young people that are like, man, I wish I could drop out of high school. And I'm like, yeah, do it. I did it, you know? So yeah. I've been thinking about that like 6 years ago, you know, just like when I was 15 and wondering what the fuck to do. And now I just, now I'm old enough to see those kids and think, oh, I used to be like you, youngin.
Yeah. So we talked just for like a second before we started recording. And you know, this is a new, this is the new way on School Sucks, at least for a while. Hey, how you doing? So, hey, Nick, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm doing all right today. And how are things looking out there in Oregon?
Good. I'm kind of same old for me, except the only thing that's really changed recently is people are more interested in coming out. No, not really. But no, the main thing is that I still do shopping and people are buying up a lot of stuff. But otherwise, man, it's the same old, but I'm a little bit more focused on like how do I produce food? Because now there's a real reason. Like there's a real risk that's apparent that we might have shortages of food.
Yeah. And you guys are pretty stocked up there, I assume, right? You're basically on a farm.
Yeah. Yeah. We've got more than enough meat to last for a long time. And then we have, you know, we've got wheat and barley. We don't really grow it, but we've got stores of grain and we got plenty of vegetable seeds.
Have any interesting inquiries come your way in the last like 10 days or so?
I've had a few people ask for meat. I'm actually out of all the meat that I sell right now. I'm out of it. So I'm not selling any yak right now, but, people are, you know, there's definitely people that are like, oh man, I could use some meat right now. And, there have been a few people that have been wanting me to like, wild mushrooms aren't really out here right now. There are some out there and if you're clever, you can find them. But, in the local area, there isn't much, but people are asking like, oh, you know, do you know where to find food? Do you know where to find mushrooms? Or
yeah,
that's the main thing.
Yeah. I was just interested because I was thinking, you know, and I wanted to also kind of tie that together with another question about how you're feeling about this whole thing and what your perceptions are. Cause for a yak herder in the middle of nowhere, you sure are online a lot. I see you. So, yeah. What have you absorbed and how are you feeling about it?
Yeah, well, this thing kind of, I've been offline mostly, you know, I've been on Facebook here on my computer, but I don't have a good phone right now. Yeah. So I've been kind of avoiding being online, but just this month, I kind of needed to pick up some work. So I've been on my email and on Facebook. And then after this happened, I thought maybe I should get a little bit more active because I do have some valuable skills that people are looking for right now. You know, people are concerned about food. I've kind of built my life for the last 6 years around food. And now I'm like, oh, you know, maybe I should put myself out there a little bit more because people are asking, you know, can you help me find stinging nettles and whatever kind of food that is available right now. People are interested in it. So I guess I've decided that I should be online more. But the thing that, you know, what I'm doing right now is I'm working in the garden and trying to grow our own food, but also just doing outside labor. So yeah, so being out in the middle of nowhere, the social chaos is not a problem. Social distancing is what we're doing. You know, we've been, that's
your life.
Yeah. Right. So, you know, like it's not all that concerning, I guess. And it's not that hard to deal with, I guess.
From where you are at this point, I understand that. And, I don't know. I was thinking the topic that I had for today for us, I was really debating it before reaching out to you, because I was like, is this going to be soothing or is this going to be alarmist? Telling people like, look, you need to go find your own food in the woods. And I'm not saying that's the case. And I really just want to frame it as like, it's nice to have options, like in a much more stable and certain and peaceful world. When I first heard about the idea of foraging, I was like, oh, that makes me feel good. And then I went and I did some of it and it was fun and rewarding. And you're actually fairly expert on this. So I wanted to just use our conversation to do like an introduction to it. I mean, obviously people are going to find, you know, unique conditions and options all over the country and all over the world. But I thought we could just talk about some general guidelines and practices, and if there's like supplies that are necessary to do this most effectively and successfully. So that's where this conversation is going. I'm actually in New Hampshire right now, and that gives me access to the southern part of this state that is fairly, it's not like a city, right? Like people are fairly spread out here. It also gives me access to like southern Maine. So I have, I know some interesting options, even though this isn't a super rich area for high quality foraging. But I also, just before we talk anymore, because we've obviously had an influx of new listeners over the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 months, that you are, forgive me, Nick, 21 years old?
Yes,
21 years old. And we first talked, as I said at the very beginning of the show, when you were about 15. You called into a radio show that I was co-hosting called Free Talk Live. You said you wanted to drop out of high school and herd yaks. That was the beginning of our relationship. Since then, you've been on the podcast in one form or another, probably 15 times for various things. And here we are today. So given that you have this background, that you were kind of immersed in this natural world, in this farming world, before I even ever heard from you in Oregon, you've got a lot of experience with this. You've been working for yourself in these trades for a number of years now. And I did see that you posted, if people were interested in like learning more about this, they could contact you. So I thought instead we could just project it out here as, you know, like a long-term, hey, everybody, if you live near the woods, there might be snacks for you kind of conversation.
Totally. And I really appreciate that you brought me on for this, because this is, you know, I was hoping for to get out to more people, just because I think that I do have that, I have some valuable information. And to start us off, to be clear, you know, the word expert is hard to get. Do I have 10,000 hours in it? I don't know. Right. But comparatively to most people, I do know a lot, and I'll try my best not to speak out of bounds of what I do know. Because like, you know, I can't give specific details of like, what can you find in New Hampshire or in Missouri or wherever, but there are some basic things that we can go over and talk about. And I think that most people would be surprised by how much food is available, in the woods or the grasslands or wherever you're from, and the non-paved spaces that are around you. I think people will be surprised by what's there. And I guess the main thing I would say is if you really are interested in this, then find a good book or a resource online. There are a lot of Facebook groups that are dedicated to foraging, plant identification, mushroom identification.
Yeah, and there's probably like a regional website wherever anybody is as well.
Yeah, totally. And that's kind of what I, you know, when people are interested and I'm just kind of talking to them, that's my first suggestion is get a book or actually, you know, that there's a really great, can't remember the name of the app. I don't have it. I think it's called Picture This.
Yeah.
But also iNaturalist is a great app too. And those you can, on iNaturalist, you can find where other people have found these plants. And
it helps you with identification too, I'm assuming, because there are some tricks like things that are edible might look very similar and even have the same common name as something that might be mildly poisonous, right?
Right, yeah,
and, exactly. And mushrooms is a bit of a dangerous game and a bit of a higher skill. You know, and one of the reasons why I just wanted to talk about this generally and hopefully do some people the service of introducing this concept, because I don't think I had ever really, like, yeah, I understand there's food, there's things you can eat outside, but I don't think I had ever really thought much about it until a conversation that I had with you and Kevin Geary. Probably, do you remember this? It was probably like 2016, 2017. And the name of the show was If You Don't Know What It Is, Don't Eat It.
Yeah.
And that was about food that you could find in the grocery store. But, you know, since the grocery store doesn't have any food today, I thought we could shift it into the woods. And the other thing, too, that I think is really valuable here, I see a lot of people. Like, so right now, I was helping my mom get set up for, you know, the period of maybe the next 60 days, right? Making sure she had everything she needs. And she lives in a condo complex. And so I set up an office on the trunk of my car in her driveway yesterday, just because it was sunny and I wanted to get some sun. And I see a lot of people who are not used to being home on Wednesday at 10 a.m., right? And they're just kind of standing in their driveways with nothing to do, or just kind of people walking around aimlessly. And, you know, I'm thinking there might be a lot of people who are getting restless. And or going to be restless by the time, you know, they hear this, which will probably be Friday or sometime next week. And this is like an option for a new activity, at least. And most of this stuff is storable. So why not talk about it?
Definitely. I think it's just a great way to get out into the nature and be paying attention, because I know a lot of people that like to go on hikes and do stuff, and that's fun. That's cool. But there's a big difference in the kind of the, I guess, the flow aspect of the enjoyment of the experience is if you're looking for something. There's something really hard, you know, hardwired into people that want to hunt. You know, like the human beings love it. You find anybody, you set them on a course to find something that they can find, and it gets obsessive.
Yeah. I mean, obviously just being out in nature is a super helpful self-care activity, but to make it purposeful, I think is an awesome bonus. So where would you like to begin as far as like a new person's guide to foraging?
Sure. I guess the way I'd like to frame it is kind of thinking about this as food, because it's, I know that like from me teaching other people and my experience of trying to bring people out in the woods, it's not always, you know, it's a fun thing to do. I'm a very excited person. So I like, you know, hey, you want to go find nettles? Let's go find nettles. And, you know, maybe I kind of breeze past the fact that you got to cook them or do whatever. And I find that people can kind of get into like, oh, we just found all of this, but what do I do with it? I think it's really important to think of this stuff as, you know, the greens and mushrooms that you're picking. These are going to be turned into food, hopefully. So the main thing is kind of keep that system and those steps in mind that, you want stuff that's going to be easy to prepare. There's some things like stinging nettles are kind of irritating to prepare. Some mushrooms have to be prepared in a certain way to do things. So, what I like to do is just start off with simple stuff. You know, if nettles are fairly easy on that, because you can wear gloves. And then if you go through the right preparation, you can take care of the stinging. But, you know, if you're trying to get into some of these weird mushrooms that have, you know, minute amount of toxins and you want to try and parboil them out, too much, right? That's too much to get into. So let's not do it. So that's the thing I like to frame this in. We're trying to get food and you're trying to make it easier on yourself. So stick with stuff that's pretty easy. And I think that the easiest things are to kind of identify and understand are some of the basic plants that look unique. There's a lot of cresses and bitter cresses that look similar, mm-hmm. and not all of them are the same, depending on your area. So what I would recommend is if you can find some of the simple things that, you know, like, hey, you find online, I like looking at cattails. That's an easy thing to identify. That's all over the country. That's an easy thing to start with. But, you know, without getting into too much detail, that's what I like to tell people is we're looking for food. So as you're going about this, I think it's really smart to start with your goals in mind and figure out where am I going to process these stuff. Make sure that if you're going to get into canning, make sure you can can before you pick a bunch. But if you're a beginner and you're thinking about this, what I would do is pick a couple plants that are in your area that are common. You just look up common edible plants in your area, and start learning about it. Just read about it and kind of learn and see what it is. One of my favorite ones out here in Oregon in the Pacific Northwest is wild ginger root. Super easy to identify because it has just this really unique dark green heart-shaped leaf. That's kind of hairy.
Yeah.
You'll see it in the understory. And the only reason I knew, you know, what it was is it's like wild ginger grows here in Oregon. I got to figure that out. And you study the characteristics of it and then you can find it. I know that's kind of like, that's not very specific for maybe for beginners. It's hard to grab onto, but,
Well, no, I think there's a really important takeaway there. That's like, get yourself a running start where there's something that's abundant and go and find that and figure out how to use that and build from there.
You know? Totally. Cause that's how I started, you know, I started off wanting to figure out how do I get my own food. My mother, it works for the forestry department. So she's always out in the woods and she would see mushrooms all the time. And eventually she got to asking people, what are those? And some of the old loggers were like, hey, that's a chanterelle. Those taste really good. Pick them. And so from there, I learned what a chanterelle was. And it's a very unique looking orange mushroom. Kind of looks like a trumpet just like sticking out of the ground, you know. That's pretty easy to identify. And then from there, I found out about some other more common edible mushrooms like morels, which grow all over the country. And those are actually, you know, I come from, you know, the mushroom identification. And then in the last couple of years I've come, you know, started to identify plants. I find that mushrooms are a lot easier to, identify because of their species. They all look different as mm-hmm. opposed to like, grasses all look kind of the same. Cresses all look the same. You know, all these different plants, they're all green and look similar to me. But yeah, like what you said, pick something that's easy to identify and go with it. And then throughout time, you'll build that complexity. And then it really helps. Like if you know somebody like me that does this stuff, it's one thing to have a new person come and be like, hey, where can I find chanterelles? But if you know a little bit about them and you can ask me a specific question like, hey man, I've heard that chanterelles like to grow in Douglas fir stands about 30 years old. Do you know of any areas like that around here? You know, I'm going to be more excited. I'm more likely to give you something if you already have kind of taken the step to understand at least something about identification.
Right. So you actually brought up one of my topics, which was habitat, right? Knowing where, I mean, and that's the preparation before you go, knowing it seemed like a really good question when I wrote it, but now when I say it out loud, it sounds like the most obvious thing in the world, right? Like, you could survey the land around you, walking distance, maybe mile radius. You know, how thick are the woods? What kind of trees are there? Is it slopey? Is it flat? Is it wet? Is it dry? And then you can match that up with things in your area that, you know, match those environments.
Totally.
So exactly. So habitat is obviously an important one. It helps you direct your searches a little better. What about, like, I know this is a big like permaculture thing, like companion plants, like things that just naturally occur together in the wild.
That's an awesome question. Something that I'm really trying to learn more about. But there are quote unquote, guilds in nature, you know, like Doug, like we're talking about this wild ginger, it grows in the kind of the similar same environments that, that you can find a lot of chanterelle mushrooms. Cause they like dark understories of fir trees. They like fir duff, mostly. So like, you can kind of like, it's not always perfect, but you know, if you find some wild ginger, it's likely that there are some Oregon grape or salal, especially, these are two different kinds of berries that grow around here. And then you might find some chanterelles too. But the one that I really like have kind of that I discovered on my own that I really like is the stinging nettle. Almost always, and I'm pretty sure both these plants grow all over. And I actually don't remember the scientific name or the common name of the other plant, but there's a plant that the stinging nettle has an acid in its little tiny hairs that it has, and that'll break and it'll sting you. But this plant, it must be alkaline or something, but when you rub it and get like a juice made out, like a little poultice, and you put it on that little sting wound, it heals it up. It stops the acid and neutralizes it or something. And right. That's really cool. So there definitely are these companion plants, and unfortunately I haven't seen very many ideas and people who write books on these that are very hip to that. But definitely there will be correlations between certain plants because they like the same environment, or they build the environment for another. Like the Douglas fir is kind of they don't really care too much about companions, but they grow tall and provide a lot of shade, and shade loving plants love that. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of think about like, if you, I don't know any more specific guilds, you know, that's what permaculture people would call it. But that's definitely something to pay attention to as you're doing it, because that's one of the best, things for mushrooms is understanding, because a lot of the time mushrooms have, instead of growing from a seed, in the ground, their substrate that they grow out of is usually another living organism. Either they're decomposers breaking down dead material, or they're living off a living one. So you can, some mushrooms you can ID based on what tree are they on, or what tree are they growing around. Like chanterelles, I've never found them growing around oaks around here, but I know that in like Alabama and in the South that they do grow primarily around oak trees, and they form a relationship with the roots of the trees, and they exchange nutrients. So you do know that like Doug firs, they love chanterelles. There's a few other mushrooms that are mycorrhizal. It's what you call that, around here. And that does help you. So if you find a chanterelle, you find an orange mushroom that looks like a chanterelle, but it's like, it's growing in the middle of a bunch of maple trees. There's no Doug fir trees around. And that's a good sign. It's not a chanterelle.
Okay. So let's actually add another variable, which is seasons. You and I are on about the same line of latitude on opposite sides of the country. And I remember, I think I commented to you guys when I was out there and we were together, this looks like where I live, only bigger. Like everything just looks, it's like, looks like New Hampshire, but just like enlarged in this weird way. So I would guess there's some similarity. I mean, I know it is on the, you know, it's 3,000 miles away from here, but as far as seasons are concerned, and I don't know if you've been practicing long enough, or I guess a question to insert right here is, do you keep any kind of like journal or log of what you're finding and when? Because I mean, right now, obviously, I'm not sure if like March, what is it, March 19th, this might seem like kind of a discouraging time to start, when we're still not even sure here in New England anyway, if we're out of the winter. So pickings might be a little slimmer than obviously they're going to be in April, May, June, July.
Totally. And that's something I just this year started keeping track on paper. What am I finding? It's funny, you know, it's different for mushrooms versus plants. Right. But, right now here in Oregon, we're having an early spring kind of, it's been pretty nice out. It's been cold, but not, you know, it's not, definitely you guys get colder winters than we do over here on the West Coast, or at least where I'm at.
Yeah.
So stuff is popping up right now. Like, I've been, you know, I'm going, trying to take people out to go pick stinging nettles right now, 'cause they're kind of on the verge of almost being too big and starting to get woody here. But I'm pretty sure that stinging nettles grow all over, so they probably grow in New Hampshire too. They might be just starting to poke up, because they don't mind a little bit of frost. They don't mind a little bit of snow. My guess is like if you don't have any many plants growing right yet, if those nettles are around you, they're starting to pop up now and from here until April, and they'll probably still be good for you. If they're just popping up, they'll be good for a couple months. But here, my guess is at the end of the month, I'm going to either end up drying all of the nettles I get, or I might just stop picking them just because they get too old and they're not tender anymore.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, that was one of the questions I had about like seasonal and timing, is that obviously things reach a peak, right? Even if you watch a farm, if things just sit there too long, obviously they're not going to be edible or at least enjoyable anymore. So right. Like knowing the best times to strike as far as what you're looking for is another important right. variable here.
And what's beautiful about nature is it's almost always trying to fill that role, trying to get something to grow. Like even in the dead of winter, there's plants that pop up here that you don't really see during the rest of the time of the year. Most of these plants aren't edible. You know, most of the ones are not interesting to humans. But it is every plant has its season, and it has a, like, I don't know if you get into planting seeds, most seed companies will give you the maturation period. You know, it'll take 60 days for a pumpkin to grow or something. All these plants have that, where there's an ideal harvest time. And most of the time with spring greens, the earlier the better. The most tender stuff is going to be the tastiest. And that's kind of the main thing to look out for. So like this year, I'm trying to really pay attention to like what's popping up. And so I found that this isn't anything you can eat right now, like, or this is a berry you can eventually, but the Indian plum was the first thing to sprout any new leaves and to start flowering. And that's really cool to notice, because it's like it started early February. So I know that that's, you know, doing its thing, and I can mark that down, but it won't produce berries until August, or maybe earlier if we're lucky. We're going to find out. I don't actually know. So that's something I'm keeping track of, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
As I learn about these things, I pay attention to this plant. Was the first thing to put on leaves. I didn't know what it was in January or February. So I looked it up, found out, oh, it's Indian plum. Turns out you can eat that. Now I kind of have a mental map of where the Indian plums in my area. And you know, after researching it, you know, you find out what's the actual food value of it. Not a big plum. Anyway, you know, I'm trying to focus on the seasonality of things. So that's something that I'm paying attention to. But one of the things I noticed this year is in my garden, And this plant grows all over. It usually waits for exposed soil near creeks and stuff. But, and I'm sure cress, it's a type of cress. It's called a bitter cress. And I don't know the specific name of that species, that variety. But cresses grow all over the country. And you can find them in these wet spots. And they tend to be pretty tasty. They have like an arugula taste most of the time.
Yep.
And that's something I really like. But this, I have a cress that just popped up. It started growing in January when it was still cold, and now it's starting to flower. So I'm kind of a little bit past. So I know that now that bitter cress I had in the garden had about a month to a month and a half window where it was really good tasting. And it's still fine now. It's just a little bit spicier and not as sweet as it is before it flowers. And that's another kind of important thing with greens and understand the season is, once a plant, they call it bolting, sends up a flower stalk and starts trying to produce seed, the greens on it don't tend to be as nutritional or as tasty, just because that plant is putting more energy into reproduction than vegetative production.
Right. And have you found good resources on the food value of things you find, as far as like nutrients and calories and macros and things like that?
I haven't found a good specific resource that I come back to, but I tend to Google things, and on stuff like cresses, since there's so many different kinds, it's kind of hard to find that out. And I've got a plant that I've been researching, and I've been talking to some people online right now, it's chickweed. And I hear a lot of people claim that it has a lot of nutritional value, similar to nettles and spinach. But then as I looked into it more, I can't really find any scientific articles. I didn't use Google Scholar. I can probably get deeper on that. So I shouldn't, you know, say I don't, but the point I'm making is I don't really have a good, I don't have a good resource for that yet. I hope that continues in the past. There is one, it wasn't Weight Watchers, but it was a diet app that has a bunch of foods that it has the nutritional value for. And it has some mushrooms. It doesn't have all of them, and I doubt it will have a lot of wild plants. But you can find stuff like chanterelles, very high in vitamin D. And you can find some of that information online. But it is lacking on especially plants that aren't very commonly, they're not eaten a lot. You know, people don't really study them.
Right, yeah. I mean, I just ask because I've begun an experiment just to see on what kind of calorie deficit on which I can function, right, and still be like mentally alert and active. And I also realized that I'm going to be missing. Let's just say there is some kind of a more dire shit hits the fan scenario ahead of most people, and things like fresh fruits and vegetables are not so readily available, or people, at least in the near future, maybe like, let's say the next month, don't feel comfortable going into, you know, a grocery store and taking things that are sitting there in the open air, right? Obviously, people are losing out on a lot of micronutrients, and even if they have a bunch of canned goods, like obviously canned vegetables are shit, and tell me if I'm wrong, but frozen is okay, but like fresh is going to be like a missing piece, I think, for a lot of people. So that was why I was curious.
Totally. I think that this is, and I wanted to say this earlier, and I don't know if I mentioned it, but it would be really hard to live off of all the stuff you could find and forage, because exactly. Most of it is just greens, and you're not going to get enough calories. But the micronutrient piece is really important, because these plants are most of the time being grown in a soil that has not been amended or used at all, except for growing plants. And this is, you know, one of these hippy dippy things. Some people disagree with me here, but I think that you can see it pretty objectively that if you remove synthetic inputs and tillage, if you stop tilling your ground and you just let weeds grow, those weeds are going to have better nutrients in them than a lot of the vegetables you would grow. You can mess around, you can put your synthetic fertilizers in it. You can create some nutrient dense food out of a garden, but compared to what nature does, compared to like the massive amounts of fertilizer that these trees drop in the form of leaves, you can't do as well. And instead of going into a place and trying to manipulate it, these plants are growing in their natural habitat. They're adapted to try and find those nutrients that they need to grow. And that since they haven't been altered by human, artificial selection, they do really well in their environment. So, and right. You can tell too, like if you find a plant that's like withering and dying, like then it probably didn't get nutrients, probably shouldn't eat it. You know what I mean? But if it's dark green looking vibrant, and you can tell the difference between a really great looking plant and one that doesn't, that's going to have a lot of nutrients. And what I'm kind of suggesting to people now and how I'm looking at this is, you know, I provide my own meat. I'm not quite there on, you know, providing the carbs, but you know, I get a lot of fat from pigs and a lot of protein from yaks. So I've got some good, calories there, but you know, now I'm trying to figure out how do I add these micronutrients into it. And I think that's really the key, is if you're looking for, plants and mushrooms, you're not going to get a lot of calories. Some have some resistant starches and like tubers. You can get stuff from some carbs from burdock or from, I can't think of any wild tubers off the top of my, or camas is the one out here. But a lot of, you know, if you look at how the natives lived, you know, they lived off the land in all the areas we live in this country, without gardens. They did this stuff a lot of the time in the wild. But they had very specific systems and practices that they used to prepare some of this food, like acorns. While oaks are all over the place, that acorns themselves are not edible raw, but if you process them, they're edible. But you and I are not going to be doing that on our own. That's something that the whole tribe got together and made. They made, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pounds of acorn mash in a week, and that's what the tribe would eat over the winter. But for you and I, you know, I think if we're really thinking about survival, we should be careful to have these more, you know, have those macronutrients on hand and stored, like, you know, have your grain, your bread, your wheat, your pasta and the canned goods, but then use this as a supplement. Don't rely on foraging to meet your needs.
No,
otherwise
absolutely.
You're going to spend a lot of time canning jam and you're going to eat a lot of jam throughout the winter. And even then you need to buy sugar.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, that is a really important thing to stress. I wanted to make sure that we did. I'm just thinking like fun and variety, you know, like until, let's see, when did I leave? I left my home 6 days ago. And before that, like every day for God knows how long, I would have at least one salad a day and haven't had one since. And that makes me sad and bored with my food. So, you know, if there's options to do that, and they're going to be far more rewarding options while I, you know, cultivate a new hobby and become more expert in a thing and spend time connecting to nature, that's like a win-win-win. So it was something that, you know, I was super excited about when we first talked about years ago, but then, you know, I went out of the house and between me and all the foraging stuff was a supermarket and I was in a hurry. So that's where I went. But yeah, now it's nice to have another option for sure. So if more people might be doing this, are there any like best practices as far as like not being a dick about it?
Sure. That's a good point.
You know, because like I just think like here, like obviously like raspberries and blackberries, chaga, dandelion greens, like those are things that, you know, we've been picking since we were kids. And people are like, oh, you know, there's this great blackberry bush out by the Exeter River, etc. So obviously people did not model the best behavior regarding this over the last couple of weeks in the United States, as far as like leave some for your neighbors. But are there any like general guidelines that people trying to do a good job and trying to be responsible should follow here?
Totally. And it's different for every plant. It's different for every mushroom, but there definitely are a few things. Like my thing is I try to leave about half of what it was there already. I don't want to go through a patch and just rake it all up. Because most of the stuff we're looking for, there's a few things that are really hard to come by, and those things probably shouldn't be harvested. I'm thinking there's a few protected species of flower, like they're lilies that are technically edible here, but they're protected by the government. You're not supposed to take them. I really recommend if they say please don't pick this is endangered, don't do it. It's not worth the food value to lose it. If you're interested in cultivating it, then that's a different story. But if we're looking for food, stuff that is on that endangered list, you know, is susceptible to damage, leave it alone. But things that are more common, like the nettles or chanterelles, and mushrooms are a little bit different, but specifically on nettles and plants that grow from seed and need to have the plants reach maturity so that they can grow seeds and then drop them. It's really important to let some of those nettles go so that they can do that and reseed the patch. Because if you take only half of them, that patch will grow. It'll grow bigger next year. And if you take more than that, there's a chance it could do good and there's a chance it'll be fine. But I find a good rule is every two or three plants you find, leave one. And most of the time you won't get them all, even if you try. But then the difference between like a nettle or any kind of plant and mushrooms is that mushrooms are the fungus itself is an organism that lives underground most of the time in the substrate, in that wood or with the tree roots. You don't see it. And the mushroom that it's popping up is just its fruiting body. It's like an apple on an apple tree. So if you pick a young chanterelle that hasn't reached full maturity and hasn't dropped its spores, it doesn't really affect the organism itself that produced that mushroom. It helps if you let it grow to its maturity and drop spores. But that's sometimes hard to tell when it does that. If you're really in tune with mushrooms and you've watched them grow, like I've grown mushrooms in my room. So I've seen them develop and I kind of understand at what point do most mushrooms drop their spores. I figure out how to explain that in a general way. So what I would suggest is if you find mushrooms like chanterelles or something, leave like, you don't have to leave half, but leave like a third of them. And that'll allow them to keep reproducing, producing spores. It'll keep their genetic diversity alive and they can keep spreading that patch as well. But there are definitely different rules for each thing, but that's the thing to pay attention to is like, how is this plant or organism going to reproduce? You know, am I limiting its reproduction by taking plants? And that's really the key there, because you want it to come back next year. And then, you know, if you're in a public area, that's a different kind of consideration for other people, you know.
Right.
My strategy out here, I don't have very many competition, is, you know, give everything you can before the this I I feel like in this culture, I got to be aware of how I, that there's a lot of Hispanic people that make a living out of the woods out here. And they're not, you know, in general, they're not as careful as I am. So they go to my chanterelle patch and everything is gone. But I try to leave some behind. And sometimes, you know, I get a little bit like, I, you know, get as much as I can. But I'm lucky that in those patches of chanterelles or wherever I'm picking, there's so many of them that you couldn't do a damage. Even these crews that are going through there, and it seems like they're just going through with rakes and tearing up stuff.
Yeah, that was another thing I was going to ask, because that's super destructive. And I know there's like some diagramming of plants. Like you think about something like elderberries, where there's a part that you can eat and there's a part that's like kind of poisonous, right? So, and the berry is the thing you can eat. And maybe there's some kind of preparation that makes it less toxic. I'm not sure, but all I know is about using the berries. So diagramming plants to know what you actually need from them, and then you're not damaging the ecosystem by taking more than you need for the sake of time or efficiency, and then just kind of processing it later. Right. It relates to another question where if people are thinking about this more long-term, and like they find things that are delicious and micronutrient rich and they just want to have more access to it, is there like with a lot of these things, I know mushrooms would obviously be much more of a trick, but transplanting and then like propagating them close to your own house, like in your own sort of wild plants garden.
Yeah, this is I think this is a great idea to do. I think more people should grow native plants in their gardens because they're adapted to the environment you're in. Why not use them? You know, it makes like, why would you be planting melons that are supposed to be grown in much hotter climate when you could be eating elderberries? You know what I mean?
Right.
So I think that's a really, I think it's a really great thing to do. And the main thing is to learn the habitat that it's in. So don't take wild ginger root and plant it in full sun because it's a shade loving plant. It tolerates a lot of shade. It wants shade. So don't give it full access to the August heat. You know what I mean? Other plants are hard. Nettles are super easy to grow. They like a little bit of shade. But most of these things, they'll grow in your natural environment pretty easily. And the thing to just pay attention to is how much shade does it like? How much water does it need? Is it drought tolerant at all? You know, if you're picking stuff off of the riverbanks, try to plant them on another riverbank or next to the pond, or at least where you can water them easily. And right. Then your more drought tolerant plants, like the lot of wildflowers and stuff that might be edible, plant them in the full sun and try and give them a space where, like, especially if something does really well. And you know, you do got to be careful with some things will end up being invasive, you know, but most of the time wild plants in your area are not. And you can, you should always research, I guess is what I'm saying, is learn the plant, know where it's supposed to grow, know what it likes, in terms of nutrients. If you really get it, like I don't really mess around a whole lot with pH in my soil, but the acidity will matter, especially with wild plants. If you're taking them out of a completely new environment, you might be putting them into a substrate that just isn't as beneficial. It won't make it grow, but I would definitely encourage, to take cuttings. If you have seeds, when you process berries, keep the seeds from the berries and,
right.
And try to plant them. And I'm doing this in some ways. I haven't had any real success with it yet. I've really just started trying this since last fall. I've been collecting some trees and some shrubs and stuff. Elderberry is one that I particularly have not had success with, but I think you have to stratify the seeds in the refrigerator. So anyway, there's details to it all, but I would definitely encourage people to try.
Right. Okay. So that just takes us all the way back to like best practices and being safe and respectable. Like, so
sure.
You know, I'm out for a walk yesterday and like I said, I'm in this condo complex right now and I'm like, this place is fucking boring. So I just wandered out into the woods and I walked for a while and eventually it was beautiful, right? Like really in a part of town that's just like kind of developed. There's like a nursing home nearby and there's a what else, I mean, you know, like the water treatment, things like this. So just a boring kind of industrial road with a couple of like condo developments and housing developments off of it. So I wandered into the woods and eventually it seemed really beautiful and I thought to myself, whose land am I on right now? Because I'm just certainly on somebody else's land. So obviously this has to be a consideration too.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And this is one that I am, I'm more careful telling people about it than I am in practice. But you really do want to be careful because it is illegal to trespass. And most of the time in public areas, state forests are different, national forests kind of different, but parks and public spaces, most of the time, they don't want you picking stuff. They don't want you removing products from the woods or the, you know, the natural areas or from a park or whatever. So you do really want to be careful. Don't be going through people's backyards and just telling them, hey, I'm trying to get food. Try to be respectful and find those places where you are allowed to harvest. And, you know, if those places are limited, you know, I'm not going to encourage you to do anything illegal, but you know, you got to do what you got to do. Sometimes, you know, there's a lot of land, big landowning corporations around here. And I don't take people out when I go and say, hey, we're going to go out in the woods. I avoid all of those private companies. If I have permission from a private landowner, I love that. And you can make relationships with these people, especially if you could bring them this wild food and say, hey, this is really good. I've gotten people to give me permission just because I, you know, showed up with chanterelles and told them, hey, I like the way your woods look. Can I take a look? You know, can I look through there on your acreage? And you can do that. But yeah, so what I would say is be careful. You can find the maps online where the state forests are, right, public areas, and be careful with the regulations and the laws. Sometimes you need a permit, especially with mushrooms. You will, I, you know, on a philosophical angle, I really think that some of that is ridiculous. How much they charge for a permit. You know, luckily here in Oregon, you're allowed to pick a gallon of almost anything, I think, of berries or plants, as long as it's, you know, depending on the plant. You're not allowed to mess with trees, but you're allowed to pick a gallon of chanterelles or mushrooms per vehicle. And you should look into the you know, what's going on in your state and in your county, because there could be some laws regarding that. But I think in terms of that, be careful of the law, be careful of people's private property. Anytime you can, ask for permission, because most people are going to be pretty cool about it. And especially if you're clear with people, like, you know, around here, you got to be careful to say, hey, I'm not bringing a rake with me, because people like to hunt truffles. And the most common way to find truffles is to dig up the roots of a dug fir tree. And yeah, that's not good for the trees. Landowners aren't going to like that. And, you know, truffles don't have very much food value. So, you know, it's not really important in this discussion, but most things that you're going to find aren't going to do that much damage to the soil or the plants around it. So you don't really have to worry too much about that. But you definitely should be careful. And also on that thing, I don't think we touched much on, like, thinking about other people who might come through, especially if it's a public area. It's easy to have that mentality of that, like, somebody's going to come and get this later, I better grab it. Mm-hmm. But if you're in a park and there's edible stuff, you know, take a little bit and leave some from other people. And the main thing I try to, like, think about is don't get greedy, because, well, honestly, if you pick a bunch of greens or mushrooms, if you have 20 pounds of chanterelles and they're going to go bad in 2 weeks, you got to eat them all. That sucks. Like, it's not that fun to eat chanterelles after a couple days.
Right. So there's some things that you can store and preserve, and there's some things that you just can't. And because there's so many things to talk about, and people are listening to this all over the country, if not the world, we don't want to go into detail about that. But maybe just a tip is, sure, like, it's worthwhile to consider, like, what's the shelf life of this thing and what are the options that you have for making it last longer?
Right,
you know,
exactly.
Can you freeze it? Can you can it, et cetera? So just knowing that before you stock up too heavily on something is probably helpful as well.
Totally.
Awesome. Well, you know, all I wanted to do today, Nick, was say, hi, how you doing? And also introduce people to the idea of foraging. So anything on top of that was a bonus. What's something that you're looking forward to this summer?
Oh, I'm looking forward to, the berries. Actually, that's the thing that pops in my mind first. I'm excited for the hot weather and the berries. I've got a lot more. I understand where the berries are. I've got new stuff to look for. So I'm excited for that. And seeing how much food we can actually preserve here is going to be the goal this summer.
And yeah, what are some basic guidelines for preservation? Like, what do people, because this sounds so great, right? It sounds so free of costs, right? But you're obviously going to need, like, supplies and equipment. So Is there anything in terms of, even though it's going to be different everywhere, just like a basic sort of universal starter kit for doing this?
Yeah, the main thing is you want a knife, obviously, to go and harvest. Clippers aren't bad. Bags and gloves are necessary when you're going out and having good boots and good clothing. You know, that's pretty much it. A tool to harvest and a tool to, you know, a bag to store it in. And then when you get home, if you have a freezer, that's a great way to store greens and stuff. It's pretty hard to ruin stuff that way. A dehydrator is really nice. We've got a big dehydrator here, and you can dehydrate almost anything and get the moisture out of it, and it'll store for at least a year. Other than that, I would say, you know, everything else is kind of is fancy. I would say you can do things in all kinds of different ways, but if I were to start out, make sure you have a knife, good clothing, a bag, and either some good containers to stuff in to freeze them. Oftentimes when you want to freeze stuff, it's good to like boil it first, blanch it is what they call it. Right. And get it and have a dehydrator, because that really makes a big difference between what you can store and what you can't. Because if anything is about to go bad and you're like, I can't use that, throw it in a dehydrator, and in, you know, 12 hours it'll lose its moisture and it'll last for a long time. But that's all I can think of.
Right. One final thing that I thought of, like, Jesus Christ, everybody, listen up. Okay. Know what the poison plants. And I don't mean like, don't okay, be out there. Like, I'm not saying you're going to be out there eating poison berries because you think foraging is so fun and you just don't give a shit about what it is. I'm talking about the thing, like, there is a coronavirus of the forest and it is called poison ivy. And it can be a little bit tricky to identify. And in some places it can hide pretty well. And it is, I mean, gee, you know, I said that like tongue in cheek, but poison ivy can get you. If it gets on your shoes and then you take off your shoes and you touch them with your hand and you know, bring them. God, I don't want to talk everybody out of this by saying this right now, but you know, you get the oil on your hands, you go and you touch your table, you go and you put your elbows on the table, and there it is on your elbows. And it can actually stay on things for a pretty long time. So I would say that's actually one of the top precautions. There's poison ivy, poison oak, and poison sumac. And I think they're pretty ubiquitous across, you know, at least the northern areas of the country. So
totally. Yeah, be aware. Like, that's the main thing I tell people is, even if you see me, like, I'll be posting some videos here soon. If you see me eat something, don't do it. Even if you think you know what it is, because somebody might have told you it's a common name of something and it might be something else. It's, right. It's hard to, some plants look almost identical. And especially mushrooms, that can be difficult too. So don't, if you have any doubt, throw it out.
Right. Yeah. Really great. And then just as far as like precautions, like, until you have like a well-worn path, be mindful of your surroundings as far as what's on the ground. You know, and I understand too. I remember being in Arizona, right, and just being terrified of rattlesnakes. And I was with somebody, and she's like, I've hiked this trail 1,000 times. I've never seen a rattlesnake. In the first 15 minutes, right in the middle of the trail, there was a rattlesnake. So there's different levels of danger everywhere. And even if you're in an area where you know there's no poison ivy, there might be something else. So always just be like mindful of your surroundings. But, you know, like, wash your clothes after you do this if you're going in new areas. Practice good hygiene.
I really think, and I try to remind people this, is I grew up out here in the woods, so it's different for me. It's safe for me to be out there because I understand the stuff, because I've been out there a long time and I learned it at a level where I didn't need as much articulation, you know what I mean? But for people that are getting new into it, the woods, that everywhere, if you're away, anywhere is a dangerous place. You really do have to be careful, especially if you're alone. Nature is not necessarily your friend. It's awesome that we can get this food from, you know, like we're talking about, it just grows on its own in nature. That's really awesome. But I tend to find that a lot of people have a romantic idea of what the woods and nature is like, that it's this calm, serene place, but, it can be dangerous. I'm lucky. I've never like ran into, any animals out there, but there are many things that can happen. You can trip on a stick and fall and hurt yourself. And there's all kinds of things that you do have to be aware of, not just poisonous plants or poisonous animals. But when you're out there in the woods, it is easy to get lost. Like, I've been lost once or twice, and thank God I had people with me. And thank goodness I know the lay of the land. You know, like, I know what side of the slope of the mountain I'm on. And I know if I find a creek and go downhill, I'll find the river that I live on. You know, like that's easy for me to do. But when you're going out there in the woods, especially far off, if you're, you know, bring a compass and bring people with you. Like a GPS is really, really easy. And I should have mentioned that in those tools. Mm-hmm. But I'm just lucky here. I forget about some of that stuff because I can go so close to home. But right. when I do go on a further trip, like if I'm going out to the Eastern Oregon for morels, I really pay attention. I map that area. I know where the closest city is just in case I do have an issue. And I need to tell somebody where's the next hospital, please get me there. And I also pay attention to where the waterways are because that's a really sure way to find civilization. If you can get down to a creek and follow it to its main river, eventually you'll find people.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. I certainly didn't, I hope people listen to the whole show cause I didn't want to glaze over that. Like I had the luxury of growing up in like some of the safest woods in the country, right? Mm-hmm. There's no poisonous snakes here. There's like, you'd have to work really hard to run into a bear around where I am. They're just fisher cats. That's it. But yeah, so I understand everybody's situation around the country is dangerous and be careful out there and know what the risks are. That's super important. Awesome. Nick, I'm so glad we got to check in and hear that you're doing well and you're safe and you're thriving and you're helping the people in this audience. So thank you so much for your contribution here.
Yeah, totally. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share. It's this really is my life's passion is trying to figure out good food. That's why I started 6 years ago and trying to figure this stuff out is I want to be able to have my own good food.
Absolutely. Do you want people bothering you right now with questions? And if so, do you have a reliable way of being contacted or a website?
Yeah, for sure. I'm thinking about setting up a little website for this idea, but I probably won't in the near future. But right now, Facebook and Gmail, you can contact me at, what's the easiest Gmail? I got a few of them. HazeltonFarm@gmail.com is a good one.
Okay.
And I check that regularly. And I don't have a lot of people bothering me at the moment. At some point, hopefully I'll pick up some more clientele. I'm not selling yak meat right now. So people aren't, I'm open to people bothering me. Ask me some questions. I may not be able to give you particular answers, but I do have some people across the country that I know. And if you're really interested in learning, definitely reach out and I can put you in contact with people and in the least get you into some Facebook groups that can help with identification knowledge. And I would say is like the best thing you can do is if you find something, don't know what it is, ask a Facebook group because there are thousands of people in there.
Awesome.
So yeah, bother me.
Oh, great. All right. Terrific. Do you still have your other website up too for like the podcast and all that?
Yeah. I'm not producing any content right now for the podcasts. And-yak.com is still up. You can find my really old work and justyakin.libsyn.com I think is up and on Facebook. Yeah. From Facebook, you can find pretty much everything.
Awesome.
I'll be on Instagram and Snapchat too.
Excellent. All right, Nick, thank you so much. And hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks, Brett.